The matter of State versus Gerald Butler. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Also Gifford, Assistant Deputy Public Defender for Gerald Butler.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Gifford, please. We're going to go till roughly 12:30. I'm not certain we'll finish the argument by then. We'll do our best.
Okay. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Prosecutors have a duty to obtain convictions based on evidence of the charged offenses. From opening through summation, the prosecutor in Gerald Butler's case violated that duty. I'd like to emphasize what this case was not about. It was not about gangs, it was not about gang violence, and it actually wasn't about any violence whatsoever. Instead, it was about whether Gerald Butler, possessed with intent to distribute contraband found in an apartment, sold drugs on one occasion, and conspired to commit those crimes. Yet, the prosecutor and testifying officers bombarded the jury with improper commentary and testimony suggesting that Butler was a violent gang member. Then, in a case that turned primarily on Butler's connection to an apartment, the prosecutor elicited improper testimony about a warrant that bolstered Butler's connection to that apartment. These errors, individually and cumulatively, made it more likely that the jury would convict Butler of the charged crimes and therefore require reversal. I'd like to discuss the trial errors in the order of my brief. I'd like to begin with the prosecutor's comparison of Butler's case to The Wire, then turn to the problematic statements about the investigation, and then discuss the search warrant issues before wrapping up with cumulative error. The prosecutor opened the case against Butler by discussing the television show The Wire, a popular show about violent drug dealing gangs in Baltimore. The prosecutor told the jury that in The Wire, there was a rash of crime happening in Baltimore, that the crime was organized and hierarchical, and that the police ultimately realized that in order to find out how guns and drugs were flowing into the community, they needed to focus on one person through a wiretap. The prosecutor continued, and I'm quoting, "That's similar to this case." The prosecutor explained that there was a rash of violence happening in Millville in 2016, and that in order to figure out its, quote, origin, the police decided to get a wire. The wiretaps ultimately led to Butler's arrest. The prosecutor drew a direct analogy between The Wire and Millville and implied that Butler was at the origin of Millville crime. This was entirely improper. A prosecutor's reliance on The Wire would be inappropriate in any case, as it's not in evidence and the show is filled with gang violence and organized crime, but it was particularly inappropriate here, where Butler was not charged with any gang-related or violent offenses. The prosecutor's use of The Wire created the very real risk that the jury convicted Butler not based on the evidence, but on the belief that he was responsible for some widespread Wire-esque crime in Millville. As in State versus Holmes, where the appellate division found reversible error in the prosecutor's reliance on the war on drugs to obtain a conviction in a simple possession case, the prosecutor's reliance on The Wire, and I'm quoting, was a thinly veiled attempt to inflame the jurors by identifying defendant with matters of public notoriety as to which no evidence was or could have ever been introduced. Bless you. Not long ago, in State versus Williams, this court cautioned prosecutors against implicit or explicit comparisons between the defendant and something the jury associates with violence or guilt. But that's exactly what the prosecutor did here. This court should reiterate that prosecutors must exercise extreme caution when making extra evidentiary comparisons and reverse Mr. Butler's convictions. If Your Honors have no questions about The Wire comparison, I'll move to the commentary. Yes, Your Honor.
I do. What is in the record in terms of what exactly The Wire is about?
It's what the prosecutor said in the very first paragraph.
You're saying that The Wire is a show that exemplifies gang violence, and you're making a statement that what The Wire is about. What exactly is in the record that we can look to say whether that's an accurate characterization of The Wire? And here's why I ask. I mean, I know there's an entire season of The Wire that's devoted to police misconduct. And that season would presumably inure to the benefit of a defendant. So what are we looking to get a from the record to be able to rely upon as to what the association with the wire means?
So I think it's exactly what the prosecutor said when she introduced the concept of the wire, that in Baltimore, there was a rash of crime. The police needed to figure out how drugs and guns were flowing into the community. And in order to do that, they needed to focus on one person. So that certainly isn't anything about police misconduct. It's about there's like a rash of crime. And that in order to get to the bottom of it, the police need to focus on one person.
So there's and nothing now, else in the record.
About the content of the wire.
Sense of the show.
Specifically, no, but it is a extremely popular television show. And I think it's fair to assume that many of the jurors had seen that show and would know that the show was about gang violence. It's about organized crime. It's about drug dealing. There's murder. And the jury from
police
the
misconduct.
And in part, Your Honor, but I think when the jury is viewed, that's not the way that the prosecutor was invoking it. The prosecutor was invoking it to say there's a rash of crime and the police need to figure out how to get to the bottom of it and they need to focus on one person. And so I think when the jury is hearing that, they're not thinking about police misconduct. They're thinking about, okay, so as in The Wire, there's a rash of crime in Millville. In order to get to the bottom of it here, there's drugs, there's guns. The police needed to focus, get a wire, focus on one person. And they're looking to Mr. Butler, who is the person on trial before them. So I think they're viewing from the very beginning of this case, the invocation of the wire is tainting all of the evidence through which they're, is tainting the ways in which they're viewing the evidence against Mr. Butler. In their mind, they have an image of widespread crime, drugs, guns, and that there's one person who's at the center of all of that.
Didn't the prosecutor in discussing the wire, the show, and then moving on to this investigation indicate and that what was happening, and they finally decided to they need to get a wire. So as they narrowed down their investigation, they narrowed it down to four individuals. And then the prosecutor made clear that Mr. Butler wasn't one of those four individuals. Not so the... it doesn't, from my reading, it doesn't seem as though the prosecution said we had to focus on one person and that was Mr. Butler. It seems like they said the opposite in getting the wire.
They need to focus on, they start by focusing on four people, but ultimately those four people lead to Mr. Butler, who is the man on trial. So I think that it's a very fair inference for the jury to make that while the investigation didn't start with Mr. Butler, it ended with Mr. Butler. And the fair assumption there is that, oh, okay, so Mr. Butler, they finally figured out who's at the center of Millville crime, and that's the man on trial. That's Mr. Butler, even if the investigation didn't begin with Mr. Butler.
But that's not true. I mean, Mr. Butler is implicated by the wire because of a collateral call from the phone that the law enforcement was up on.
Yeah, he was eventually implicated through a wiretap. But I'm not saying he wasn't implicated through a wiretap. The prosecutor said he wasn't the initial target. They first wiretapped four people, and that led to Mr. Butler and to a wiretap of Butler. So in response to Justice Pierre-Louis' question, I was just saying that the fact that the investigation initially focused on other people doesn't mean that the assumption for the jury to make was that it was Mr. Butler who was ultimately wiretapped and at the center of Millville crime.
Isn't it possible that Justice Hoffman's question, that there was one interpretation that you're suggesting that could be what the state was putting forward, but the defense easily could have gotten up in their opening statement and said, and we've also seen The Wire, and there is a whole season dedicated to police misconduct, and that's what we're alleging in this case, to sort of diffuse that analogy. This isn't one that's so clear like the Shining example that we have, where that I think nobody would disagree that the violence and what was implicated by that scene and that image can only be seen one way, versus here where there may be other arguments that could be made. How deep into it should we be delving to decide whether or not this is fair or not?
I think what's really important here is just the context in which the prosecutor invoked the wire. She says there's a rash of crime. They had to get to the root of it by getting on a wire. Like, same thing in Millville. There's a rash of crime. Had to get to the root of it by getting on a wire. And so I think both in and that in and of itself is just asking the jury to picture Millville as, you know, similar to Baltimore in The Wire, and to picture Mr. Butler at the center of Millville crime. And I think as in the State versus Williams with the Shining case, obviously the Shining, The Wire, it's not in evidence. It's not fair comment on the evidence because in both cases, which I'll get into in a bit, but the state's case did suffer from evidentiary holes. And in both cases, the prosecutor is using this extra evidentiary pop culture comparison to fill the holes. I mean, specifically, in this case, well, actually, you know, if it's all right, before I get into the harm, I would actually like to talk about the testimony and commentary about the investigation itself, because I think that really, you know, that really built off of the prosecutor's, you know, erroneous comparison of this case to The Wire, because it wasn't just in isolation. It wasn't just one reference to The Wire. Then throughout the entire trial, there's ample testimony and commentary about the size, scope, and background of the investigation that make it seem like Mr. Butler is part of some huge, widespread organized crime, gang violence, gun trafficking, drug trafficking. And again, none of that was supported by the evidence. So I think when you have the prosecutor's use of The Wire in opening and then coupled with all of these comments throughout the trial, it made the Mr. Butler seem like he was part of a much larger and more nefarious operation than the evidence would permit.
How do we balance this though? Because there are times where, you know, this is not in evidence, right? These arguments are not evidence. They are trying to build analogies, both attorneys, right? Mm-hmm. Prosecutor, defense are trying to build analogies and metaphors to establish their case. Defense attorneys sometimes rely on the lack of CSI evidence. And if you've seen CSI, you know what to expect. And here you're not going to see, you know, all of these things. What's the limit in terms of the prejudicial take, given Justice Hoffman's position that the show might have ample room for both sides to argue that it's exact opposite of what the state's arguing?
I think the limit is that when it's the comparison, the reference itself is prejudicial and it's used to fill a gap in the state's case, that's...
But isn't it always going to be prejudicial when the state's making it, right? The state's making the analogy for the purpose of trying to support their evidence against the defendant in that case. It's always going to feel... that it's meant to mount its case against the defendant, but prejudicial is something else.
If the prosecutor says, you know, in CSI, there's always DNA evidence, and there's not DNA evidence in this case, that is not necessarily invoking in the jury's mind images of something that could be used to fill a gap. You know, that's comparing the defendant to, you know, a particular person, a particular image of something very prejudicial that's used to fill a gap in the state's case. There was no need for the prosecutor to invoke The Wire to introduce the concept of a wiretap. That's a pretty straightforward concept.
Isn't your argument, even if The Wire had been used only to educate the jury about what a wiretap is, it seems like it would have been a different case. It seems like here, even if the jury didn't know anything about the TV show The Wire, which again, probably unlikely, but maybe there was a juror who had never heard of it, the prosecutor specifically says, in that show, there was in Baltimore a rash of crime. It seemed very organized. People were always at certain locations. They seem to be following a hierarchy or someone's order. They're trying to figure out guns and drugs and how it's all coming into the community. And they're looking at all these locations. They can't find them. And then eventually they realize that there's one person they need to focus on. That's the only way to find the guns and the drugs and how they're flowing into the community was to get on that person's phone. So they got a wire that's similar to this case. So it's not that the prosecutor is just saying, this is what a wire is. It's when someone taps a phone. The prosecutor is saying, there's all these guns and there's all this drugs and it seems like it's organized and everyone's in different places and it all comes back to one person and that's like this case. It seems like that is a problem regardless of what else could or could not be found in the TV show itself. No?
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think it would be unnecessary to, you know, and improper to invoke The Wire in any context because it's unnecessary. It's not in evidence. But here, that wasn't just what the prosecutor did. The prosecutor explained what happened in The Wire and then said, that's like this case. I mean, similarly, in the Shining case, the prosecutor held up the image of Jack Nicholson as he's, you know, using an axe to cut through a door to say, actions speak louder than words. It's getting into the details of what happened in that case and asking the jury to extrapolate and pull comparisons from that, you know, reference to the evidence before the jury. So I'm not taking the position that any reference to any, you know, pop culture, anything extra evidentiary is always going to require a reversal. I think most of the time it's probably unnecessary. But whether it amounts to reversible error, I think it's important to look at, you know, the context of the comparison, you know, how unrelated it is to the evidence and the details, obviously, of the comparison and whether it's used to really fill a gap in the state's case.
unless I misunderstand, it goes right to the just to interrupt this moment. They did not go up on Butler's phone, right? They caught Butler on a collateral call. They weren't up on Butler's phone, right?
Originally, but then they wiretapped Butler after that. After they originally, they were wiretapping another person. That person reached out to a number that they thought was Mr. Butler's, and they wiretapped Mr. Butler's phone. And then, you know, the bulk of the evidence was against Mr. Butler was wiretapped evidence. So the wiretap was, you know, it was an essential part of the case against Mr. Butler. And I think the jury could have, you know, certainly concluded that, you know, as a wiretap in the wire was necessary to get to the center, the person responsible, that was here, Mr. Butler. And, you know, as I alluded to before, the prejudicial nature of the wire comparison was really just like, you know, emphasized over and over again throughout the case, because the officers testified about the background, size, and scope of the investigation in a manner that made it seem like Butler was involved in, you know, violent gang-related crime. And so, first, over defense counsel's objection, five officers testified that they worked for the Organized Crime Bureau, and the lead officer testified that the investigation leading to Butler's arrest was a large-scale weapons trafficking and narcotics investigation that targeted violence in the city of Millville, as well as weapons trafficking throughout the country. That officer also testified that the investigation began in response to several shootings in Millville. All of this testimony fails Rule 403's basic relevance test. Neither the name of the unit investigating Butler nor the scope of the investigation made it more likely that Butler committed the charged crimes. Instead, these details just encouraged the jury to prejudicially speculate that Butler was involved in a large and violent operation. The prejudicial nature of the officer's testimony was exacerbated by the prosecutor's improper statements in opening and summation. As we discussed, in opening, the prosecutor said that the investigation began in response to a rash of violence. And in summation, the prosecutor told the jury that the case involved a huge wide-scale operation, which was about gun violence in the city of Millville. Again, Butler wasn't charged with any gun violence or any violence at all. And as with the wire comparison, all of these statements implied that the state had knowledge of Butler's criminal involvement beyond what was presented at trial, and encouraged the jury to convict based on that criminal involvement as opposed to the evidence.
So the introduction of the idea that they worked for the Organized Crime Bureau, is it your point that they should not be able to discuss what unit they work for? Because those units, right, they're rarely going to have simple, gentle, kind names. I mean, there's the narcotics unit. And so would it have been different if these officers had worked for the narcotics unit and they introduced themselves and says, yes, I'm a member of the narcotics unit? Would that have been just as problematic?
It wouldn't, Your Honor. The problem here was the disconnect between the name of the unit and the charged crime. So you can imagine saying that an officer works for the narcotics unit in a drug trial, works for the homicide unit or the major crimes unit in a murder trial, that's not filling any sort of gap. The jury knows that this is a murder trial and this is a drug trial. But the organized crime unit, that has, you know, gang connotations. This wasn't a case where Mr. Butler was charged with any gang-related offenses.
He was charged with conspiracy.
Conspiracy, but that's different from some more, you know, leader of our narcotics trafficking network, promoting organized street crime, gang criminality, racketeering, leader of organized crime. Those are other crimes where it might have been more appropriate for the officers to say they work for the organized crime unit. But conspiracy doesn't necessarily mean that the defendant is involved in gang-related activity. And the state needed to provide evidence that he was involved in gang-related activity if they wanted to use that to support a conspiracy conviction, which they didn't do here. So the issue is that the use of the organized crime unit is, allowing the jury to speculate that Mr. Butler is involved in gang-related activity, and that's why he was investigated by the organized crime unit, and therefore made it more likely they would have convicted on something such as conspiracy, not based on the evidence, but based on the name of the unit.
Counsel, is this particular argument about the use of organized crime bureau identifying the unit your strongest argument?
It's one of many arguments. So, I mean, I don't think that this was the, I think the use of the wire, the testimony about the warrant, which I'm going to get to, and
let's focus on the other arguments.
Okay, and the details about the size and scope of the investigation about it was in gun violence in response to shootings. I think all of these things really work together to just make it seem like there was other evidence outside of what was presented to the jury
Chief, I had one question about this argument. The appellate division seemed to say that it was had to be reviewed on plain error because it was unobjected to trial testimony, suggesting that defendant was involved in crimes investigated by the Organized Crime Bureau. But you would oppose that because there was an objection to the any reference to the Organized Crime Bureau or large scale organized crime investigation, correct?
Yes, that was all objected to before trial and the court ruled that it could come in. So that would be reviewed under harmless error, not plain error.
Was there supposed to be, was there some conversation about a limiting instruction? What happened there? It seemed like that just fell away.
There was, the court offered a limiting instruction and the defense attorney said, you know, let me think about that and whether it would highlight it more than I would want it to be. And then there was never any limiting instruction. So I think we can infer that defense counsel made, I think, a fair strategic decision not to draw more attention to the organized crime unit than was necessary. The same exact thing happened in State versus Williams, the Shining case, where the defense counsel objected to the use of the Shining, and both the court and the defense counsel agreed that a curative instruction would actually do more harm than good because it would just draw more attention to the prejudicial issue. And so I think
do you have an argument as to that today, whether or not the court should consider limiting instructions on situations like that, where for many different reasons, the names of different squads or units of the police department or law enforcement agencies could be used and throughout the course of trial, and rather than to have to object and stop at each turn, that perhaps an instruction should be given to the juries generally?
Perhaps an instruction could be given to juries that, you know, the jury shouldn't draw any conclusions about the guilt of the defendant based on the name of the unit. But I think it may be best dealt with on a case by case basis, because I do think it was fair here for the defense counsel to say, I'd rather not have a limiting instruction because I don't want to draw more attention to the name of the unit than necessary. So I think I would leave that to the discretion of the defense attorney to decide based on the facts of the case. The final issue I would like to talk about is the improper warrant testimony before, again, turning to talking about cumulative error and the specific harm in this case. As your honors are aware, the bulk of the state's case turned on Butler's connection to apartment 16D. And so any improper testimony strengthening his connection to that apartment was highly prejudicial. That's exactly what the improper warrant testimony here did. Four separate times, the prosecutor elicited testimony that Butler was the target of the search warrant executed on 16D. And this harm, the harm from this type of testimony was articulated in State versus Milton and State versus Alvarez. In both of those cases, the defendant was charged with contraband found in a house that he shared with others. And in both of those cases, the defense was that the contraband could have belonged to one of the other residents. In that context, testimony suggesting that defendant was the target of the search required reversal because it suggested additional evidence was presented to a warrant issuing judge that wasn't presented to the jury. That's exactly what happened here. Butler was charged with contraband found in an apartment where he and many others stayed. Butler's defense was that the contraband belonged to someone else. And while the jury heard some evidence connecting Butler to apartment 16D prior to the issuance of the warrant, this evidence was far from overwhelming. So testimony that the warrant targeted Butler specifically when the jury knew the apartment was used by others, invited the jury to speculate about additional evidence presented to the warrant issuing judge that pointed to Butler. Butler was also prejudiced by repeated and unnecessary testimony about the existence of search and arrest warrants. In State versus Kane, this court reminded prosecutors that while a search warrant can be referenced to show that police didn't act arbitrarily, repeatedly mentioning a search warrant can permit an impermissible inference of guilt. In Kane, this court found that mentioning a warrant 15 times in opening, summation, and questioning went well beyond what was necessary, had little probative value, and had the capacity to lead the jury to draw an impermissible inference that the court issuing the warrant found the state's evidence credible.
I thought Kane said that there couldn't be repeated mentions that a search warrant was issued by a judge.
In Kane, I believe only some of the references to the search warrant said that it was issued by a judge, and that made it even more prejudicial. But
let's stop for a second. How many references altogether to the existence of a search warrant, and how many references to the fact that a judge authorized it?
In Kane?
In this case.
There was no discussion of the fact that a judge authorized the warrant, but there was seven mentions of a search or arrest warrant, and four times there was testimony elicited that defendant was the target of the search. And so there was no, in Cain, what this court emphasized is that the purpose of introducing a concept of a search warrant or the fact of a search warrant is to show that the police didn't act arbitrarily. But here there was no dispute that the police, you know, acted lawfully. And in fact, before trial, all the parties agreed to follow Cain and to refer to the search as a lawful search as opposed to referencing a search warrant. But here we have kind of a combination of a Cain and a Milton Alvarez problem where there was unnecessary repeated references to search and arrest warrants that, you know, many of the jury members know those are issued by a warrant issuing judge. And so could cause the jury to speculate that a warrant issuing judge found the state's evidence credible. And also a Milton Alvarez problem where there was very little evidence connecting Butler to the apartment 6D, especially as opposed to all the other people who use 16D prior to the issuance of the search warrant. So the fact that he was the target of a search warrant could have led the jury to also speculate there was additional evidence outside the record incriminating Butler that wasn't presented to the jury.
How does it factor into your analysis that he was acquitted of one of the charges of evidence that was recovered post-search?
I don't think that impacts my arguments. That gun was found underneath a couch where another person was staying at the time of the search. And so Butler had a really strong argument that that gun belonged to someone else.
But doesn't it support the idea that the jury was able to independently make a determination of the evidence and evaluate it all properly and wasn't unfairly influenced by the state's repeated comments on the warrant issue?
I think the court's repeated comments on the warrant issue and Butler being the target, in addition to all of the other testimony suggesting that he's, you know, part of some, you know, violent gang, the fact that the jury acquitted of the gun charge, as I mentioned before, Butler had a strong argument of a third party guilt on that charge. It was a less clear argument of third party guilt on the other charges. So the fact that he was the target of the search warrant as opposed to someone else, and that, you know, the use of organized crime, the wire, wide-scale investigation into gun trafficking and weapons trafficking, the jury could have found that even though he didn't possess that one gun that was, you know, underneath a couch where someone else was sitting, he was more likely to possess with intent to distribute the drugs found in the apartment because he was the target of the search. And there were all of these references that made it seem like he was the, using 16D as some sort of headquarters to operate his, you know, drug dealing gang activities. I'd like to also touch specifically on harm and cumulative error in this case and talk about the specific charges, because to obtain a conviction, the state needed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Butler possessed with intent to distribute contraband found in 16D, sold drugs to Joshua Phillips on one occasion, and conspired to commit those crimes. The issue is that the state's case on each count suffered from evidentiary holes. Regarding 16D, no one saw Butler possess the contraband found there. Much of the evidence suggested the contraband belonged to someone else. Butler wasn't there when the apartment was searched. The apartment was leased to a different person. Many people stayed there, and much of the contraband was found in another person's personal bedroom. So any error suggesting that Butler was a criminal gang member and strengthening his connection to 16D made it more likely the jury would convict him of possessing with intent to distribute the drugs found there. Regarding the suspected sale on one occasion, the evidence there was also problematic. The surveilling officer couldn't see the seller or any money or drugs exchange hands. The out-of-court identification of Butler as the seller was problematic, and his testimony identifying Butler as the seller in court was tentative. He said Butler may or may not have been the seller. So again, the error is making it seem like Butler was a criminal gang member using 16D when the sale happened close to 16D, could have influenced the jury's verdict on this count as well. Finally, I just want to touch upon conspiracy. There was really no evidence in the record that Butler was working with others to possess with intent to distribute drugs as part of a conspiracy. To the extent the text showed anything, they showed individual drug transactions, which, as the appellate division even recognized, is insufficient to establish a conspiracy under Wharton's rule. I think it's kind of helpful to compare the evidence in this case to State versus Roldan, where the appellate division found sufficient evidence of a conspiracy. And there was 700 pounds of cocaine being transported across state lines. Everyone was reporting to their supervisors. There was $250,000 of drugs at issue. That's just like simply not what we were looking at in this case, where at best the evidence supported individual sales. So again, any evidence suggesting that Mr. Butler was a gang member, was connected to 16D outside of the record, could have influenced the jury's verdict on conspiracy as well.
When you say references to Mr. Butler was a gang member, is that just because of the reference to them working for the Organized Crime Bureau, or were there more specific references to Mr. Butler as a gang member?
The combination of the wire, the invocation of the wire, organized crime, and then also just that this was a large-scale investigation into weapons trafficking and guns weapons trafficking and narcotics trafficking. That, you know, there were multiple people being investigated as part of this investigation. Multiple people were arrested on the same day as Mr. Butler. Again, none of this was admissible evidence, but together, I think, led to kind of a common sense conclusion from the jury that Mr. Butler was involved in some sort of gang-related or organized crime.
Thank you, counsel. We'll have you back for rebuttal. Mr. Rosenberg?
May it please the court. Rarely is there sufficient and legitimate justification for a prosecutor in opening statement, legitimate and sufficient justification that outweighs the potential for prejudice for a prosecutor in opening statement to make the sort of wholesale analogy to a case that is not in before the jury. Particularly something like a fictional case, in this case, The Wire. And I'm not talking about simply references to popular culture. I'm talking about what happened here, which was, as Justice Wayne or Apter went through, a fairly detailed summary of the facts that are set forth in a work of fiction and telling the jury that this is similar to this case. And there's at least three reasons why that is uniformly not permissible. The first is, by definition, the prosecutor is going outside the evidence. When the prosecutor is detailing what happened in a work of fiction or some other work of popular culture and telling the jury that's similar to this case. When the prosecutor says this case is similar to that case, that in itself is a statement of purported fact. And here, even this morning, we had a discussion all of a sudden as to whether the wire was about also police misconduct in addition to being about ganglands. And that is not what is supposed to be happening in a trial of the case before the jury. They're not supposed to be debating what happened in a work of fiction. They're supposed to be concentrating on the case before them, which is a second point. When you're asking the jury to conjure up facts relating to fiction, you're really dealing with a recipe for prejudice, and particularly in the opening statement. The opening statement has outsized influence over juries. It sets the thematic framework. It constructs a prism through which the jury is going to be assessing all of the evidence. And by raising this gross similarity of a work of fiction with the case before the jury, the prosecutor is asking the jury to view the facts through that prism of the work of fiction, and that's improper. And third, it's just not necessary. It's really difficult to conceive of circumstances where it's necessary for the prosecutor to tell the jury that this case is similar to a case that's not before the jury. And this case here really illustrates that quite vividly. Justice Wayne Apter went through what was essentially the first third of the argument of the prosecutor here. And by the end of that, I guess it was 7 or 8 sentences, not one of which dealt with the evidence that was actually going to be presented by the prosecutor at trial, it is reasonable to assume that at least one, if not most of the jurors, thought that this case was about drug-laden gangland violence and that Mr. Butler was at the center of it. And that, as the prosecutor says in his brief, the prosecutor did not specifically compare Mr. Butler to Avon Barksdale or Stringer Bell or Omar Little. What the prosecutor did was essentially compare Mr. Butler to all of the characters in The Wire. The prosecutor also says that, well, this was helpful to instruct the jury on the complexities of obtaining a wire intercept. The entirety of what the prosecutor did in that regard was two sentences that say the only way to really find out how the guns and drugs were flowing in the community was to get on the person's phone, referring to what happened in the wire, so they got an intercept known as the wire. That's it.
And then the prosecutor goes on to say, that's similar to this case.
That's correct.
And that's what the prosecutor is saying is similar to this case. The prosecutor isn't saying all these things that I've said about violence in the area are what is similar. What the prosecutor said is similar is that we use a wiretap to investigate.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor, but leading up to that saying that's similar to this case are about 10 sentences detailing the violence in the city of Baltimore, the hierarchy, that there was someone who was giving orders, all of that leading to the implication that this case is obviously has to do something with this case.
So you're saying that that's similar to this case refers to those 10 lines behind and not the immediately preceding point?
I'm saying two things. I'm saying one, the way it was structured with the prosecutor starting off with this detailed summary of violence and a hierarchical organized crime in Baltimore, and then saying, so we had to find out why the guns and drugs were flowing into the city of Baltimore, so the people on the wire got a wire intercept. That's similar to this case. That kind of says to the jury, everything that came before is similar to this case. But beyond that, there was no reason for the prosecutor to go into that detail to supposedly instruct on the complexities of getting a wire. All they said is, we have to find out why who was behind this, so we got a wire. You don't need to go to another case, be it a work of fiction or some other work of popular culture, to for the jury to understand that.
Is the language that followed problematic as well? Because after saying that's similar to this case, which arguably referred backwards in time, there's then a description about why the organized crime unit did it in this case, because there was a rash of violence, paraphrasing the very same words, it was happening throughout Millville and throughout the summer of 2016. Is that of concern as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The entire opening, the entire opening statement was to set this picture of violence, gangland violence, drug-connected violence with someone at the center, and that someone in the juror's mind naturally would be Mr. Butler. And then the prosecutor also says, well, we needed it in order to explain to the jury that targets sometimes tell on themselves. Now, I don't think the jury necessarily needed to be instructed that sometimes people self-incriminate when they don't know they're being overheard. And you certainly didn't need to tell that from a television show. And just because it happened in a television show doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. So it just... There is really, this goes back to the point that this isn't necessary. And there's this potential for prejudice. So I think this court has to really, I know it's done in the past, instruct prosecutors that they have to be very careful before they make these kinds of analogies. Now the prosecutor also says, well, this is nothing worse than explain to jurors that Northeast winters are very severe by referring to The Shining. And I was actually surprised to read that. Who would have thought they could have come up with maybe a more helpful analogy for themselves, something maybe White Christmas, or if I'm dating myself, maybe Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. But The Shining, do we really think it's appropriate for prosecutors whose duty is to ensure justice, to say something to a jury like, this case begins on a cold, wintry, snowy night in Millville, just like in The Shining? Is that really what prosecutors are supposed to be doing? I think not. Yesterday I was here listening to the argument in Mustafa, and all of a sudden the DAG stood up and said that when he was arguing, he said that he wanted to talk about an analogy to a movie, Sling Blade. And Justice Patterson, I didn't see the movie either, but he described it as a movie dealing with a person who had epilepsy, who was convicted or who actually murdered someone. And he was using that to discuss the issue of whether or not there can be a diminished capacity defense for certain medical conditions. And it really struck me, and I know you all are not a jury, but there's a real slippery slope when you allow the use of analogies. And it's not simply references. It's analogies saying this case is just like that case. Prosecutors should not be allowed to do that. And I would ask the court to please issue guidance to that effect.
I have a question with respect to your position on search warrants in this case, but I just want to say one thing, and please don't take this as chastising you. I'm mindful of what might evolve in the Mustafa case. The court will not consider comments. Allow me to finish.
Yes.
The court will not consider comments that you just made with respect to that argument in its deliberation on that matter. Please go ahead.
Yeah, and I
wasn't intended that way.
Intended at all to deal with the merits of the arguments in Mustafa.
Would you spend a moment on your position on testimony with respect to warrants?
We've not briefed that. We rely on Ms. Gifford's argument to that effect.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Sayre, why don't we start? It's 12:15, and we will do our best to get through the argument, although not by 12:30. If it looks like that's a false hope, we may stop and resume it a little bit later. Please go ahead.
Understood, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case asks whether brief contextual references made to media in an opening statement without direct or arguably general comparison to a defendant constitutes reversible error, as well as whether the usage of the name of the investigating unit in this case and whether certain references to the defendant being the target of a search warrant in this case constitutes reversible error. It is the position of It is the position of the state that the defendant did receive a fair trial in this matter. I'd like to start with a discussion of the prosecutor's reference to the television show The Warrant in this matter. It is the position of the state that it is neither improper nor prejudicial what the prosecutor did in this matter. To address what was raised a moment ago, the reference to The Wire was made as part of the prosecutor's opening argument in this case, setting the initial impetus and scope of the initial investigation. She was talking about how there was certain criminality in the city of Millville, and the investigation was into these incidents that specifically she mentioned did not involve Mr. Butler, and that ultimately Mr. Butler was brought into this by being heard on one of these wiretaps going into these other individuals who weren't Mr. Butler, being contacted about trying to purchase a firearm in this matter. Ultimately, the reference to The Wire was about articulating the purpose and functionality of a wiretap, and that was part of it. It was explaining the circumstances in which a wiretap needs to be brought in because it's particularly useful under these circumstances, as outlined at length in those initial preceding statements by the prosecutor in this matter. It's also part of a...
two questions about that. Where specifically did the prosecutor say that the defendant was not a part of, quote, a rash of violence that was happening throughout Millville and throughout the summer of 2016? That's from the opening.
Yes.
Where she says, this is happening. You said she said defendant was not a part of that. I see where she says that defendant was not one of the original four individuals who they got a wire on, but I don't see where she says that defendant was not a part of a rash of violence that was happening throughout Millville and throughout the summer of 2016.
That is accurate, Your Honor. Intended statement to that effect is that what the prosecutor was saying is that this initial investigation was started because of this rash of violence in Millville, and she clarifies that those individuals that were being looked into as a result of this were not the defendant, and that the defendant ultimately became a part of it when he was heard incidentally on the wire.
Why is even that not problematic? So as Amiki pointed out, the point of an opening is to create a prism through which the jury will view the evidence. Here there was evidence of a drug transaction and possession of drugs and a conspiracy to engage in the drug transaction. Why is it okay to say I just want to give you the larger context for this case. And the larger context for this case is a rash of violence that was happening throughout Millville throughout the summer of 2016. Isn't that creating for the jury a prism that they should see the defendant as part of this rash of violence, especially when the prosecutor never says, and that had nothing to do with the defendant, but...
It would be the position to say, it's not that the reference to the wire was necessary. It wasn't necessary, but it was helpful. And the consideration for the court in reviewing whether it was improper is, I believe that's Stevie Wakefield and Stevie Papasabas, where the standard that the court is to assess is not whether it was necessary, but whether it was so egregious that it deprived the defendant of a fair trial.
So let's go back to basics for a second. This defendant was charged with particular allegations, particular offenses, as to which it was entirely appropriate for the state to introduce evidence that bore on the charges. But he was not charged with committing a rash of violence, an unspecified gun violence, in the city. So how is it appropriate to inject comments in the opening and in the closing with respect to that?
Right, because these references were defining the origin and scope of the investigation, which would be helpful.
Could you keep your voice up, please?
Sorry, this was about the origin and scope of the investigation. It was helpful to the jury to articulate how the defendant became involved in the investigation.
So let me ask you about a passage in closing with that in mind. The prosecutor says there's a huge wide-scale operation known as That's All Folks, references a call that was listened to, and then says, it's going to be up to you to determine what was that call about in the context of the overall investigation, which you knew it was about gun violence in the city of Millville. Is that appropriate? Was that something that the jury needed to determine as it evaluated the call?
I think that goes to what the appellate division referred to as being unnecessary language. And it certainly was unnecessary, but it is the position of the state that this did not deprive the defendant of a fair trial.
Was it more than unnecessary? Was it inappropriate for the state to present that question to the jury?
It would be the state's position that on the record in this case, it did not deprive the defendant of a fair trial. It wasn't so egregious as the standard would state because of the record.
Was it inappropriate?
That it is not inappropriate for that remark in the summation would be unnecessary and not ideal. But
was it accurate? Is that what the jury's responsibility in this case was, to determine whether a particular call, how it fits into the context about an investigation and relates to gun violence in the city of Millville?
It is accurate in the sense that it is asking the jury to assess whether the defendant essentially, as she said in the opening, told on himself. To that extent, it is calling for the jury to make a position as to the sufficiency of the evidence against the defendant on that point.
I'm afraid I don't understand that. I understand the first part of the comment. Up to you to determine what that call was about. I don't understand the relevance that the prosecutor was then asking the jury to determine here.
Just ask it in a different way. Wouldn't it be unfair for the prosecutor to say, in considering whether the defendant committed this particular crime, you have to consider his relationship to this huge, wide-scale operation known as That's All Folks, which had been described throughout trial as a rash of violence happening throughout Millville? Is it fair for the prosecutor to say, in determining if defendant committed these very specific crimes he's charged with, you have to consider this huge rash of crime in the city of Millville, and it had a special name, and it was a wide-scale investigation. Is that fair?
I think that that is largely mitigated by the fact that throughout the trial, whenever this discussion of the violence in Millville was brought up, particularly by the testifying witnesses, it was clarified that these instances did not involve the defendant, Mr. Butler.
But then the prosecutor specifically is connecting them to the defendant, as the chief pointed out, by saying that it's up to the jury in the context of the overall investigation, which you knew it was about gun violence in the city of Millville. So the prosecutor is doing the opposite of saying this has nothing to do with the defendant.
That is the case. Given the totality of the references to this criminality in the state of Millville throughout the trial in this matter, the position would be that the jury was repeatedly reminded that the defendant was not involved in these, and this unfortunate remark in summation does not necessarily, given the totality of these references, rise to the level of denying the defendant a fair trial.
In addition to all of these, as I see it, substantial problems with the reference to the wire and so on, was there a pretrial order precluding any reference to the warrant as a search warrant?
Yes.
And was that pretrial order violated?
The pretrial decision to bar references to the search warrant was obeyed in spirit, in the sense that if you were to look at the, and I don't mean to stray from the wire issue initially too much, but the references to the search warrant in this case, I believe there were four references total to the term search warrant. They were fleetingly over the course of a multi-day trial by the state's witnesses. And
I hate to interrupt you, but what I'm trying to figure out is we have an order that says don't refer to the warrant as a search warrant. Did the prosecutor elicit testimony about a search warrant and violate that order?
In the sense that the witness did erroneously refer to a search warrant that was in violation of the order. However, the prosecutor did not belabor the issuance of a search warrant, and it certainly didn't become a theme of the prosecution. The case law seems to suggest that this becomes problematic when the discussion of the search warrant comes up, when it is weaponized by the state as a way to create a judicial endorsement of guilt, because the jury would then know that a judge authorized the issuance of the search warrant. In this case, the search warrant, I apologize, Your Honor, this wasn't repeatedly brought up by the state as a way to make that sort of implication.
Shouldn't have been brought up at all.
It was erroneously brought up. I think the record
Who erroneously brought it up?
I believe that the intention from the prosecutor in asking her questions to the testifying witnesses was not to get them to acknowledge a search warrant. She was talking about a lawful search, and I believe they responded by saying, yes, search warrant.
Didn't she mention, I'm sorry, the word search warrant once?
Yes, she did mention the term search warrant. That was immediately in response to the law enforcement officer witnesses' usage of the term. And it was a fleeting remark that was made immediately in response to the law enforcement officer witness. This, again, would go to the idea that this wasn't something that the prosecutor was making a theme of the prosecution in this case, as the case.
What about the defendant's point that it's not only that the word search warrant was mentioned, but that it was repeatedly stated that the defendant was the target of the search warrant, even though, for example, defendant did not rent the apartment that was searched, etc.?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, Your Honor?
The defendant seems to be arguing it's not only the fact that the word search warrant was mentioned, it's the fact that there was repeated eliciting of testimony that the defendant was the target of the search warrant, even though he wasn't there at the time of the warrant, he didn't rent the apartment that was searched, etc. So trying to tie the defendant to everything found in the apartment.
Case law seems to problematize this target language when it is about creating the implication of undisclosed evidence. I believe this is what State v. Milton and State v. Alvarez is about. In this case, the reason there isn't the same capacity for prejudice as those cases is because there was a discussion that was put in front of the jury before any language of the defendant being the target, that this was preceded by the state's showing of what led to the issuance of the search warrant. By the time that they heard this target language, they had already heard recordings of the defendant and his voice being identified by an officer and by its connection to Facebook and by him calling himself Mr. Butler online, his voice arranging for the sale and distribution of controlled dangerous substances. So where there isn't the capacity for there being a implication of undisclosed evidence that led to the issuance of the warrant, this would be a case that differs from Stevie Milton and Steve Alvarez in that significant way.
Do you agree that both with the issue regarding the warrants as well as the commentary during opening and closing that there were objections made and that we should be looking at this under harmless error, not plain error?
The record seems to reflect that there were multiple instances where it was not objected to. There are arguably instances where it was objected to. It is a combination of...
Which one are you referring to right now?
The references to violence in the city of Millville, as well as the, were you referring to the
warrant? The warrant comment we were just talking about.
With a warrant, it would be a harmless error analysis, where it seems that there were spattered objections on that basis.
And the opening and the closing?
The opening and closing, the standard of review would be based on Stevie Wakefield and Stevie Pavasavis, which is...
Sorry, please slow down and keep your voice up.
The question would be whether the statement was so egregious that it denied the defendant a fair trial. And it was not, it was-
Say no objection in those cases.
Yes.
There was an objection, sorry, to the opening, right?
There was
you're just saying it doesn't matter for the purposes of the standard of review?
It does not rise to the point of being so egregious that it denied the defendant a fair trial. Your Honor, to briefly jump back to the issue of referring to the wire in this case, we discussed that the state's or the defendant's primary reliance on that subject is Stevie Williams. It is the case that the circumstances of this case are very, very clearly distinguishable from Stevie Williams, where the prosecutor in that case was showing a picture of a murderous, villainous character wielding an axe and trying to make an argument in favor of the thesis that actions speak louder than words, that the defendant in that case had a similar criminal propensity to the character, and for that reason, there was a moral equivalence between them. In this case, the prosecutor did not make any specific or general reference to any characters. The prosecutor was merely invoking the concept of a television show to explain the purpose and functionality of wiretaps.
Let me just change it a little bit, just to go back to the chief's point earlier. If you remove the reference to the wire and any fictional product, was it appropriate for the prosecutor to sort of lay out her opinion of what was happening in Millville at the time and sort of describe the condition of the city and the violence and all of these features without making a reference to a fictional program? Would that have been appropriate?
It would have been appropriate because it was providing necessary and important context for the jury to understand the context in which the defendant's criminality became known to.
What elements of the offenses charged here do any sense of violence in the community have to do with the crimes charged against this particular defendant?
It does not relate to elements of the crime, arguably, aside from the conspiracy charge. But without providing a context for how the officers came upon the defendant in this case, the implication could be that the state was engaging in arbitrary surveillance.
No, I'm sorry. Why could it not have been, the state had a wiretap for a particular investigation, and as part of that, defendant was caught or heard doing X. I'm just not sure why it is. I understand why the state would want to say this was part of a large investigation into a rash of violence, but it seems like the state would only want to say that so that the jury would assume that defendant is part of that. So where is the permissible reference or the non-prejudicial reference to a rash of violence happening in Millville and connecting that to this investigation and this defendant?
It is prejudicial to the defendant in the sense that any analogy made by the state would be prejudicial. It is providing necessary information for the jury to understand the functionality of wiretaps.
What rule of evidence are you relying on for that? Openings and closings are supposed to relate to the evidence. What evidentiary rule supports the proposition you've just given us?
Your Honor, I'm relying on Stevie Wakefield and Stevie Pavasavis for the idea that the reference, while not tethered to a specific evidentiary rule, did not deny the defendant a fair trial because it wasn't at that level of egregiousness.
Is it because the state was trying to explain how it is that the defendant was introduced into this situation? Because the initial call was not on a call on which the defendant's phone was up on, right?
Yes.
So So, and that, I think that's what we're all struggling with is I understand that the state needed to explain how it was that the defendant was introduced into this because there was a bigger investigation and that, and there was a collateral phone call that came in. But I think the question that everyone is struggling with is there's a lot of detail for a case that doesn't involve any of that detail. Now, counsel asked, was that necessary? I'm not sure that's the standard, but it's still an important question.
The state would concede that it was not necessary, but it was helpful. And where the standard is not to determine, it's not that the state can't make remarks unless they're necessary. To the extent that it was helpful, it had a clearly identifiable purpose behind why the state was bringing it forward, and it was not so egregious that it would have denied the defendant a fair trial.
You could see it was also potentially harmful.
I think that we can conclude that it was not potentially harmful specifically because of the split verdict that happened in this case.
Because of what?
Because of the split verdict that happened in this case. On this subject, the defense is essentially asking this court to believe that the jury was simultaneously so biased against the defendant because of this reference to a television show that they believed that the defendant had a similar criminal propensity to characters that appear on the show, such that they found the defendant guilty of the distribution of CDS charge, but simultaneously not so biased as to find the defendant guilty of the possession of a firearm charge.
Are you saying that it's there cannot be cumulative error if one of the counts in the indictment results in an acquittal? It's not determinative?
Well, the standard for discerning whether cumulative error occurs, my understanding, is whether the jury was diverted from a rational appraisal of the evidence. I think that it strongly undercuts the defendant's argument that the jury was diverted from a rational appraisal of the evidence when we see that the jury returned a very discriminating verdict that
found. But the specific charge, that the defendant was acquitted of is second-degree possession of a weapon while committing a CDS offense, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and here the gun was found on a couch that someone else, inside a couch that someone else was sitting on, correct?
That is correct, but there was testimony from a witness in this case that the defendant had slept on that couch the night before. And in either case,
it's possible that the jury could have found that the defendant was not specifically guilty of possession of a weapon while committing a CDS offense because the gun was found in a couch that someone else was sitting on, but still more likely to be involved in a conspiracy because of all the references to The Wire and organized crime and so many organized, everyone appears to be going to a place and it appears very hierarchical, etc.
It is absolutely possible, but it does undercut the defendant's argument to the extent that it shows that the jury was finding the defendant guilty where the state had sufficiently proved the charges and acquitting the defendant where it found the state lacking on that basis.
Counsel, how much more would you like to present in terms of time? Give us a rough sense.
10 minutes, Your Honor.
And let's take a break for a half hour because we'll have rebuttal afterwards and I don't want to cut into everyone's lunchtime. Our staff is very, very conscientious and patient with us. We will take a break now and resume.
Thank you.